This year was a huge one for gay rights in America, probably the biggest ever. In June, the Supreme Court decided in Obergefell v. Hodges that gay marriage is a legal right nationwide. But that took years and many other cases to get there. Just 2 years ago, the United States v. Windsor went before the Supreme Court, and the justices ruled that the Defense of Marriage Act was unconstitutional. Roberta Kaplan is one of the lawyers who won that case, and she's just written a book chronicling that legal journey. Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor, and the Defeat of DOMA. And Roberta, in your book, you chronicle your own personal journey, too, from being a closeted college student and young law student to being one of the best-known lesbian gay rights attorneys in the country. And you write about the day that you came out to your parents back in 1991. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so I had very bad timing that weekend. I had kind of waited, as you said. I was not exactly a campus radical in terms of gay rights or anything else. And I had very much waited until the bitter end of my third year of law school to ever have the guts to really come out. But my bad luck, just after I did, my parents were coming to visit. And even worse luck, it was Gay Pride. So as they were coming to visit my apartment in New York City, they lived then and now in Cleveland, and they were going through the parade and the floats and all the people dressed up. By the time they got to my apartment, I think it's fair to say they were kind of in high dudgeon. And my mom kind of started to talk about, well, she didn't understand what everyone was so proud about and what's with all the rainbows. And it turns out one of my college roommate's mom was then Manhattan Borough President Ruth Messinger.
Mm-hmm.
And so she said, you know, what's Ruth Messinger doing leading this parade? On and on and on. I said, please stop. My mom, as mothers and daughters often do, continued. I said, please stop again. And she said, well, why are you saying that? Are you gay? I said, yes. And she literally walked a couple feet over to the corner of the apartment and started kind of banging her head against the wall. You know, people laugh about it often when I tell the story today. It is kind of funny now. It wasn't
only
funny
in retrospect.
Then. Yeah.
Only in retrospect.
People say it was like a Seinfeld episode. I'm like, yeah, but it was way before Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about my mom. I mean, it's not a criticism. My mom's asked me to forgive her about 10 million times for that, and I have. And like so many other people, she's evolved on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I was pretty low at the time. And I went around asking, here's the incredible thing. I went around asking for a psychologist who's good at gay issues to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And the name I kept getting was Edie's spouse, the Aspire.
And although you only saw her twice, it sounds like she had a huge impact on you.
She did in so many ways that are in some ways so mysterious that I'm not even sure I can grasp them fully. During those sessions, she talked to me about this lady she had been with for many years by the name of Edie Windsor.
Mm-hmm.
And how Edie was this brilliant mathematician and how she was at NYU and on and on. I can still remember it. I think Thea was convinced. I was so despondent and so stubborn, frankly, that Thea was convinced that the only way she would persuade me that I could have the kind of life that I wanted was to tell me about her own.
Mm.
So I actually knew Edie Windsor's name 18 years before I ever met her.
Well, okay, let's fast forward 18 years. By that time, you're a high-profile, successful lawyer. You're an out lesbian at a big corporate law firm in New York. You've argued and lost the case for marriage equality before New York's highest court. But you get a call from a friend telling you about a woman named Edie Windsor who wants to sue the federal government for not recognizing her marriage to her partner of 44 years and requiring her to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in estate taxes. So you go to meet Edie at her Manhattan apartment, and you write in your book that when you walked in, you needed a moment to collect yourself because you knew you'd been there before many years ago.
Yeah, I basically walked in the apartment. It was exactly, looked exactly the same, at least as my memory remembered it, as my brain remembered it. I saw the chair where Thea sat as my doctor. I saw the chair where I had sat as her despondent patient.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, you know, all those emotions came right back to me. And I said to Edie, you have to give me a minute. I've been here before. I then explained to her why. And then I think the next thought in my head, and I'm not sure I expressed it to Edie back then, but the next thought in my head was that God had given me this opportunity, this way to thank Thea and to show her how much I appreciated what she had done for me. And I was going to do this to pay her back.
Mm. So it just felt like fate that you had to take Edie's case.
Yeah, it really did.
Well, what is it about Edie personally? As it turned out, people across the country came to fall in love with her. And when did you realize just how big a rock star she was?
really that first day in her apartment. I mean, just upon talking to her, upon hearing her, upon realizing how charismatic she was, how articulate. And then on top of it, you know, she and Thea had the kind of marriage that anyone would want, mm-hmm. right? Who wouldn't want a spouse like Edie if you were a quadriplegic and had to, you know, deal with MS the way Thea did? I don't think anyone wouldn't want that. Mm-hmm. So, again, I knew it would really resonate for people.
When you filed Edie's case, you write about how in your brief for the court, you had chosen consciously not to use words like same sex, opposite sex, homosexual, heterosexual. Why?
You know, my view is, and this is from my experience of litigating any kind of case, is that words matter. I know they matter in what you do, Indira, and they matter in what I do. And when I thought about it, people who are comfortable with gay people don't use words like homosexual and heterosexual mm-hmm. or, you know, that's the same-sex couple that lives across the street. They say that's the gay couple mm-hmm. or the gay guys who live across the street. So I insisted that in our briefs, the only words that we use were gay and straight, because I think that's the language that Americans use when they're comfortable with gay people.
Mm-hmm. You were also the only gay lawyer to argue in either Windsor or Perry, two gay marriage cases that went before the Supreme Court at the same time in 2013. How did that feel for you?
You know, on the one hand, I tried very hard throughout the case to kind of keep my own stuff out of it. I believe I have to do that for any client. And given the fact that, you know, as a married lesbian, DOMA obviously had negative impact on me, I thought it was even more important here. So I really struggled. You know, I had this post-it on my computer that said it's all about Edie Stupid. And I think part of that post-it was to kind of constantly remind myself to that I had to keep my own stuff aside.
That it's not about you.
It's not about me. It was only about Edie and only about getting her money back. I think there are times at the argument where kind of the Robbie Kaplan seeped out. I just couldn't keep it down anymore. Mm-hmm. If you listen to the transcript that day, there's a point where my voice kind of cracks when I answer a question from Chief Justice Roberts. In the end, I don't think it was a bad thing. You know, I don't think it was lost on the justices that I was the first gay person to stand up there in 2 days. And I think the cracking in my voice probably, it certainly wasn't planned, but I think it ended up being pretty effective.
The Windsor decision was a huge milestone, of course, but it was not the end of the road because though the justices struck down DOMA, they did not go so far as to legalize gay marriage nationwide. Were you disappointed by that?
I'd say disappointed but not surprised. I think what was most surprising, though, was how quickly it happened. I was thrilled in Windsor. I gave a speech saying that I thought it was the Battle of Normandy and the struggle for gay rights. But if you told me that it would only take another 2 years to get to the final win, I would have told you that you were nuts. I can't believe how quickly it happened.
And that was Obergefell versus Hodges.
Exactly. That was in exactly 2 years to the day after Windsor came down.
All right. Well, let's look forward now. Gay marriage is now legal across the country, but many cities and states are still putting up barriers to gay and transgender people. We saw this when Houston, one of the most diverse cities in America, voted against non-discrimination protections for gay and transgender people. So in your view, what is next in the fight for gay and transgender rights? What cases are you working on?
Well, I personally, I've kind of adopted the state of Mississippi as my kind of second home state. Mm-hmm. And Mississippi still has a law on their books that says gay couples cannot adopt children. So that needs to get done. I'm hopeful that we will win that case, that the judge acknowledged in court that we were right on the merits. So I'm hopeful about that. But we need to keep doing the kinds of stuff that was happening in Houston in terms of the civil rights ordinance, and we actually have to start winning them. I think most Americans don't appreciate that at least technically there are a lot of states where you can get married, but there's no civil rights protections under the law in terms of your job or housing or stores. And that's not cool. Mm-hmm. We need to fix it. I think we will, but there's obviously what Houston shows is there's a lot more work that needs to be done. And particularly on the transgender issues, I think we have a lot more educating of folks that we need to do.
On gay issues specifically, now that gay marriage is legal, do you fear that people are going to tune out and that it's harder to get people to rally around these other very real issues that still remain?
Yes and no. I mean, you're always going to have the Kim Davises of the world.
Meaning the court clerk.
In Kentucky who kind of made a spectacle of herself by refusing to marry gay couples in her county. In a crazy way, I think it's a gift because I think it keeps focus on these issues. It means that people like Kim Davis are always going to lose. There's no question about that. So I think you're going to still see attention to it. But I think getting people to focus on the real needs out there, the homeless LGBT kids, so many of the kids are homeless on the streets, are homeless because they were gay or transgender and kicked out of their homes by their parents.
Mm-hmm.
Focusing on the gay elderly, which is a huge unaddressed problem that needs to be worked on. I'm ultimately an optimist, so I think we'll keep focusing on it and people will give their hearts and their minds and their work to work on it. But there's no question that that's what we need to do. We also, by the way, need to have a cure to AIDS. You know, the drugs are great, but we're the most technologically advanced country in the world, and we should have a cure.
Roberta Kaplan is one of the lawyers who won the historic Supreme Court case that struck down the Defense of Marriage Act. She writes about it in her new book, Then Comes Marriage, United States versus Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. Roberta, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Adair. It was really fun.